And welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
Hey listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue is the end-to-end solution for insight, outreach, and analytics for higher ed advancement and stewardship teams around the world. Recently, we launched Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub, where subscribers have access to over 100 hours of free, on-demand original series and podcasts, all created with fundraisers in mind. We're thrilled to feature the Development Debrief on Evertrue Studios podcast network. Check us out at evertrue.com/studios.
This week, we get some AI forecasting from Andrew Gosen. He reflects on how much has developed over the past 6 years and shares predictions about ways our work will change and evolve. Andrew outlines the risks and rewards of keeping up with artificial intelligence and how we should think about human time versus machine time. Andrew Gosen is the Executive Director for Communications, Marketing, and Participation in Cornell University's Division of Alumni Affairs and Development. He joined Cornell in 2010 to integrate emerging digital technologies, among them social media and crowdfunding, into the division's strategic plan. Previously, Gosen spent 8 years at the Alumni Association of Princeton University in a number of diverse roles. His focus is using digital technologies and approaches to engagement to build audiences and mobilize them on behalf of a range of causes and organizations. In addition to speaking frequently on this topic to domestic and international audiences, he has served Case Commission on Alumni Relations, co-chaired the Case Joint Commission Task Force on Social Media, and received a Case Crystal Apple Award for Teaching Excellence in 2018. Gosen holds a bachelor's degree from Princeton and a doctorate in social anthropology from Harvard University. Now let's get started. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to The Debrief.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Where are you talking to us from today?
I am talking to you from my office in Ithaca, New York.
Wonderful. Is it a home office or an external office?
Today, I am in at the external office. One of the interesting aspects of the whole post-COVID hybrid work style for me is that initially I was thinking it's great that I get to stay at home. And over time, I've come to realize that I'm just much more productive in at the office. So now I'm in consistently 4 days a week or sometimes even five.
Well, we are here today to talk about AI, and we have some really exciting questions. It's a huge topic, but we're going to take it in bite-sized chunks and hopefully inspire conversation. But before we do, I would love if you could talk to us about your role and the scope of your role, so that we understand where you're coming from with your responses and the work that you're doing.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good starting point. So my current role is I'm Executive Director of Communications, Marketing, and Participation, which in effect at Cornell is all of the traditional communications and marketing work, including the PR piece and the campaign communications piece. But in our case, we did a reorg back in 2020 that folded participation level giving into my team as well. The idea there was that good marketing is good marketing, regardless of whether you are asking people to sign up for an event or to volunteer or to give. And therefore, we ought to consolidate all of the people who do that type of marketing in the same organization with a single budget, with a single reporting line. So that's what we did. And I've been at Cornell since 2010. I came on board as part of a big investment by Cornell in digital outreach and digital engagement in the aftermath of the stock market collapse of 2009. When you think about it, it makes total sense that Cornell would have invested there because we are right here in 10 square miles of reality, right between New York and Toronto, kind of in the middle of nowhere. So Cornell has always been dependent on good outreach to be able to engage our full alumni community. I've always been sort of entranced by the notion that Cornell was founded because Ezra Cornell made his fortune in the telegraph industry. And that was a communications technology that disrupted things. And those same technologies are still incredibly important here Cornell today, not just in the academic sense, but also in terms of how we go about engaging our alumni audience. So because of that, from the beginning, my role involved thinking pretty systematically and aggressively about ways in which we can use emerging technologies to better engage our constituents and hopefully inspire them to engage or to support the university philanthropically or in an ideal world, both. So that started with social media. We then dove into crowdfunding. Over time, we did a big digital strategy that ended up culminating in the first of the Cornell Giving Days. And we actually just had our 10th Cornell Giving Day last week on Thursday. So that's a full decade of Cornell Giving Days. Over time, I got moved out of alumni affairs and into a role where I was more directly and explicitly serving the fundraising and the engagement sides of the house. And then with this reorg that I just mentioned, we're now in the position where this entire communications and marketing and participation level giving function is consolidated under me. And we are explicitly and unapologetically digital first. That doesn't mean digital only, because we still recognize the value of print and sort of more bespoke handwritten communication in the right moments. But we do think very systematically about how we can use digital technologies to better engage our audience. And I guess that's why I'm so excited by AI and its emergence, and that this feels like the next big thing on the horizon that's going to shake up what we can do on behalf of Cornell for our audience, and hopefully continue to deliver results in the future.
Sounds like you've been in such an exciting role where you're really invited to be entrepreneurial and innovative.
That's accurate. I'm grateful for it. That's not something you can take for granted. I've spent a lot of time talking to people who are thinking about similar issues at other institutions, and there are a lot of really, really smart, creative people out there who simply aren't in a position where they can try things out. And I think for most of my team, that's a real draw. We know that's something that people pay attention to when we're posting positions and recruiting folks. And part of the culture that we're trying to build here is one in which we not only think about the future and where things are going, but we actually do something about it. Mm-hmm. There's a real emphasis on testing and proof of concept, and how if something seems like it's going to work, how it can scale throughout the rest of the organization. And I'm sure that same dynamic is going to apply to this exploration of AI.
Definitely. And just anecdotally, are you aware of other institutions having the role the way yours is designed? Because I haven't really heard of it until now.
When my role was initially created, as far as I'm aware, it was the first dedicated social media position mm-hmm. in an advancement shop. And obviously many places have since made that type of an investment.
Right.
This current position is still pretty cool. We're getting an increasing number of calls from other schools who are interested in what the reorg looks like in practice and what sort of opportunities it's opening up. And if we could do it again, what are the obstacles that we would have avoided if we'd been able to do so? But it feels to me like it's a natural direction for this suite of functions that's engaging the broad base to be moving in, because the data is really the connective tissue that makes it all coherent from the audience's perspective. And right. Having all the folks touching the broad base audience in that way, sitting together and thinking about the engagement data and the broad base giving data in such a way that we can start asking really interesting questions about how people move from engagement to giving and then back, and how do you move them through the pipeline and elevate their giving. I think there's lots of strength in this type of a consolidated structure.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited to hear more sort of through your answers. So one thing I want to just highlight is that it sounds like this has been such an evolution over a period of time. It's not as though one day you woke up and decided, you know, either we need to create a task force or we should start talking about AI. It sounds like it's really come through a series of sort of commitments and priorities that have already existed. And I'm aware that you and your team did host an Artificial Intelligence and Advancement Summit at Cornell in 2018. It was actually in February, so almost 5 years ago.
Pretty mind-blowing, yeah.
Or 6 years ago.
That would be 6 years ago.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So how much have things changed between then and now, right?
Yeah. Like what's happened in the last 6 years?
Well, it's been interesting getting ready for the podcast. I was looking back at some of the things we pulled together, getting ready for that. At that point in time, so my team is very technology and future oriented. So we were pretty sure that this was going to be a big thing sometime soon. And the notion was that based on our experience with social media, it's easier to wrap your head around something if you understand the fundamentals. So right. We developed that conference as an early attempt to have a group of advancement folks come together and sort of talk through the fundamentals. And it was surprising how hard it was to pull together a program like that in February of 2018. Mm-hmm. One of the really weird things was that it was almost impossible to find experts who could come in and talk about this who are not academics. And don't get me wrong, I love academics. We all support academics.
Right.
But having an academic AI researcher come in and try to talk about the implications of this emerging technology to an audience of practitioners who operate in a world that the academic doesn't understand well, that was tough. But we found some folks at Cornell who were willing to come on in and give it a try. We found some people in industry who were right at the very bleeding edge of commercial deployment of AI in service of not necessarily advancement functions, but just more broader commercial functions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it went pretty well. The other thing that was interesting was how retrospect was how abstract it all was. So we went through the plenary sessions. We sort of got a sense of these things that are theoretically possible with the data set of the right size. And then we broke up into groups to talk about, well, how might this play out in mass marketing? How might this play out in individual giving? How might this play out in prospect research? And it was interesting, but it was also incredibly abstract. So we came out with a list of things that on paper might be able to happen someday. And I think that's the real seismic shift that we've seen happen. Someday is here now. People no longer need to think about this in the abstract, since with the release of ChatGPT, especially back in the fall of 2022, people now have a certain amount of hands-on experience with these tools. And it's a different type of brainstorming when you've actually got a car you can take out for a drive and then you can report back on where you might be able to go with it, as opposed to imagining what a car might be like that you could use to get somewhere someday.
It also seems to me like a lot of the implementation is coming from outside vendors, not from inside institutions. Do you think that's accurate?
I do think it's accurate. I think that's probably the only way that we're going to get productive tools in the hands of staff fast, just because of the pace at which change tends to happen within higher ed. I mean, right. That's always struck me as one of the great ironies of working in higher ed, is that you've got all these academics who are actually at the very cutting edge of the innovation. But then you've got these administrative units that are way, way, way multiple generations behind, and
yeah.
Working as hard as they can not to have to spend the money to stay up to date or change right. their processes. I mean, the litany of reasons why people don't want to evolve is long and ever growing. But that's there. And I think one of the first ways in which many advancement staff are going to encounter some of these tools is actually because the technology companies integrate them into tools that we're already using. And all of a sudden, you've got these new capabilities that are part of your Office 365 suite that weren't there last week. At Cornell, we actually just for the first time got campus-wide access to Microsoft Copilot. And I think it's going to be fun seeing what happens as people realize it's there and that it's really sort of DALL-E and ChatGPT-4 with a different skin and can begin to try to figure out how it fits into their daily workflow.
During our prep call, you mentioned the Gartner hype cycle. What is that and why is it important for advanced professionals to know about it?
This is actually one of my favorite illustrative devices ever. So the Gartner hype cycle comes from Gartner, which is a technology consulting company. And it's a visual and conceptual presentation of how emerging technologies mature through five phases. So I'm going to try to describe this in a way that listeners can visualize this in their heads. Imagine a standard x-axis and a y-axis. Along the x-axis, you've got time. Along the y-axis, you've got expectations. And then there's a curve that starts down there right near the intersection of expectations and time. So lower left. And there's an innovation trigger there, right? So that's the first stage. Then there's this very steep curve that goes up as time begins to move over towards the other end of the x-axis. You get up to this peak, which is the peak of expectations. Then there's an equally precipitous decline on the other side that goes down into the trough of disillusionment. And then you have a much more gradual curve moving upward, which is the slope of enlightenment. And finally, you flatten out in the plateau of productivity. So this tells a story that is actually pretty clear and pretty compelling. Something happens. People get all excited about it. They then realize that it's actually not a silver bullet that's going to eliminate all their problems. They get bummed out. They're like, oh, it didn't have the impact we thought it would. But gradually, people begin to play around with it, and they begin to figure out how it actually works in a particular context. And finally, you end up on the plateau of productivity. What I find so compelling about this is that this particular curve has actually played out in at least three instances over the past 10 years that I've been paying attention to. This is how it worked with social media. This was how it worked when smartphones really began to become widely spread throughout the mobile phone using population. It worked to a similar extent with blockchain. And the reason I think this is important for people thinking about AI to recognize is that it is inevitable, given the fever pitch of the AI hype right now, that we're going to go down that slope into the trough of disillusionment, and everybody's going to be all bummed out. And we have to recognize that that's not a problem. It's not that the technology doesn't work. It's that we just haven't figured out how it works in advancement yet. And as we head up the slope of enlightenment, the only way we climb that slope is if we do structured experimentation with the tools, and we figure out how they work for advancement in general, how they work for particular shops. And eventually we're going to get up to a plateau of productivity the way we have with a lot of these other emerging technologies we've seen. But there's no shortcut. We have to go through that cycle. And I'm totally confident in saying that we are really right there at the peak of expectations right now. I don't know about your email and your LinkedIn and your Facebook, but the number of certificate programs, crash courses, retreats that are promising that they're going to reveal to you how you deploy generative AI throughout the enterprise, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to see that there's this level of focused attention on it. But I also think that since ChatGPT launched in October of 2022, I just don't think that there's enough data out there yet to substantiate the amount of vocal, let me show you how to do this content right. That we're seeing. It may be different in different industries. Like we were saying earlier, clearly higher ed is sometimes a little bit behind the times when it comes to enterprise-wide embrace of these emerging technologies. But I don't think we're there yet. I think we're probably seeing in a lot of these courses mapping out of ideas in which these technologies might take us.
Right.
But I suspect the conversation is going to feel very different in 3 to 5 years from now, when we actually have well-documented use cases that help us see what the actual impact is.
Yeah. And in the conversations I'm having, it feels like our industry is at a stage where we all agree that we need to understand it and start trying things and testing things out. But I think there's still a very strong sense of fear permeated around using different forms of AI and risking data breaches and, you know, confidential information. Just in last week's episode, the guest that I was speaking to was saying exactly that she knows that it's important and that it could help us, but she's not sure how it could help in a way that is in line with the organization's ethos and privacy and et cetera. So I think the elephant in the room is, how can we explore in a responsible and safe way?
I think it's an important elephant, and there's also an elephant that's almost even antecedent to that, which is acknowledging the reality that people are going to experiment with this anyway. Like that was one of the big takeaways from social media, right? The folks who are thinking about policy, I guess they were pretending social media wasn't happening. So it's a slightly different dynamic. But it was very clear that with the explosion of social media, the reason that I got excited about it to start with was that all of a sudden I could publish content to my audience without having to bother the web people, because I just built my audience on Facebook, right? And as far as I know, I started the first ever Alumni Association Facebook page at Princeton back in 2000. I think this was early 2009, might've been late 2008.
That's awesome.
So that was fabulous, right? Yeah. And there was this bizarre moment when, I think it was right when Elena Kagan got nominated to the Supreme Court. And there was a CNN story that was out about it. And I was like, oh, this is fabulous. This is exactly the kind of thing I ought to share. And I got the wrist slapping call from University Communications about 3 hours later, because I had jumped ahead of their communication plan about it. But I mean, that was a perfect example of a technology evolving faster than an administrative unit could wrap its head around it.
Yeah.
So I experimented because there was nobody who understood what was evolving to the extent that they could tell staff not to do it.
Right.
If that makes sense, right? And so I'm completely confident, having had conversations with some of the more early adopter folks around the division here, the people have been playing around with it. I've been playing around with it. I spent time right after ChatGPT-4 was released trying to see what it could do with annual fund appeals, right? And fun little experimentations, like having it do it in a different voice. I spent some time trying to do sort of opposition research and have it make a case of why people shouldn't give to Cornell, to find out what the objections might be. Because, you know, if this is really ingesting material from around the web, maybe it might be useful to find out what the obstacles might be. So I guess the point is that regardless of whether or not an organization feels like it's ready to engage with this, if you've got good staff, and just about everybody has good people on staff, they're going to recognize the opportunity. They're going to start playing around with it. However, they may not be aware of the full spectrum of ways that you could get yourself into trouble. So thinking about how you do this responsibly, it feels to me like, first of all, you've got to give people permission to do it, because the technology is such that it's available to anybody who wants to use it, and you can't gate it off. Following on from that, you need to give people guidelines, because there are very simple guidelines you can use to keep people from falling into the most obvious and avoidable of the pits. If you really want to make sure that this is being done in an above ground and responsible way, I think you need to prioritize giving people tools that you've actually signaled are okay for use, because there are some tools that are much more legit than others. And if you can warn people off from the sketchier ones, that makes lots of sense. And then I guess the final thing I'd say is that you probably want to convene a group of people who are inclined to play around with an emerging technology like this, and have them actually start talking to each other. So you don't have a bunch of people who are reinventing the wheel. You have people who can build on what someone else has done. And you can just convene this conversation of people who are going to help your organization slowly ascend that slope of enlightenment and hopefully get to a plateau of productivity.
So you mentioned access to tools, and so I'm curious what tools you're working with / encouraging at Cornell.
So it's interesting in that we have a big new sort of AI for use by administrative units strategy that's been put together by Central IT. And I think it's actually a pretty good one. I mentioned that we just got access to a campus-wide enterprise version of Microsoft Copilot last week. Yeah. There are other tools that have begun to pop up in the context of things like Salesforce Marketing Cloud, where the Einstein Analytics package has a bunch of AI stuff that's integrated in there. But this administrative use of AI report, really, it breaks things up into three discrete categories. And I found this useful to just think of what these categories of things are and how we might encounter them. And I apologize for the jargony-ish terminology here, but that's how the report is written.
Yeah.
So they talk about vertical or embedded AI, which is the scenario where all of a sudden something pops up in the most recent version of Marketing Cloud that you can now access as part of your standard workflow. They talk about end user enterprise, large language model, AI services, which I really think is sort of like a white label ChatGPT that's for your organization. I think Microsoft Copilot is one version of this, but I guess some of the other ones I hear about a lot are Azure, OpenAI, and Claude and the like. And that's sort of a ChatGPT-esque thing that has data protections that safeguard the data that you put in there so that it doesn't flow back out to the open web the way that it would if you were just using ChatGPT-4. So obviously, if you're working in advancement, data security is a big, big, big thing. And I mean, that's one of the most obvious things that staff need to understand is that you don't take any personally identifiable information and dump it into one of these third-party platforms unless you're confident that there are data safeguard provisions in place. And then the final category that they talk about is generative AI platforms, which are really intended to mean custom developed platforms using generative AI that are built by people at your organization and that address specific business needs or business use cases. And there
like it's pulling things out of the database, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And there you can imagine that if you think about things like using machine learning to develop new models to identify who the people are in the graduating class who are most likely to be major gift donors 25 years down the road based on all the data you've got in your system. Mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of scenario where some sort of a custom developed platform would really be handy. But that gets interesting in that you think about what type of developer talent you need to be able to build things like that. And I would argue that probably how advancement shops are hiring developers now is completely different from what we're going to need 3 to 5 years from now to take full advantage of this. So that's where you know, I get a little bit unsettled, but also very excited by the potential. But we're only going to be able to take advantage of this potential if we evolve our organizational structures and how we think about things like what developers do to take into account that this is what it's going to take full advantage of this down the road.
And would you see the same way we have people focused or responsible for social media that we would have developers embedded under communications, or where do you think those people would live in the org chart?
I suspect that they would live under IT, but it's so interesting. I've been talking about this with my boss, who's the AVP for Alumni Affairs, and we were talking about innovation and the need to make sure that we're in a position where we can continue to innovate. And it feels to me like if we make the right investments in the technology ecosystem and the developers who can take advantage of that, the sooner we get to a point where we can really begin to develop our own large language models or our own AI enhanced applications, that's the point at which this is going to unlock a huge amount of energy for advancement shops, because we have lots of people who have good creative ideas that are difficult to execute, because in order to execute them, you need to have a certain amount of resource devoted to making that happen, right?
Yes.
So what generative AI does is it makes it happen, but in a way that a non-specialist can instruct the system what it needs and then sort of iterate with it and teach it what it needs so that it gets better and better at doing this over the time, right?
Yeah.
So you think about things like web forms, you think about things like web pages, you think about things like proposals for donors, you think about things like renderings of buildings that you could include with a proposal. Right now, producing all of that stuff is incredibly time and labor intensive, so we can't do it very often. But if we get the tech stack right, and if we get the developers right to custom tailor the things that we need in a way that works for the organization, and then we train staff to be able to use this, suddenly everybody can be a potential source of innovation. And it's not like the innovators have to argue amongst themselves for the resources to actually try this out. We'll just be in this incredibly exciting new space where 1,000 flowers actually are blooming. And then you can show them all to the audience and see which flowers the audience likes best, right? I mean, I think that's the long-term vision here, and that's going to be pretty transformative.
I love the way you describe this, because I think it's really hard to imagine what it looks like at this stage. And I think all of the comparisons that you've made to social media makes it really easier for me to understand how much social media changed our world. I feel this feels like it will change it even in bigger ways, but you talked about the similarities. What are the differences, do you think, with the arrival of AI and social media?
That's a super interesting question that I've been thinking about a lot. So one big difference we've already sort of signaled, which is that higher ed tried to pretend that social media wasn't happening for a long time until it became so obvious that they couldn't maintain that sense anymore.
Right.
Whereas I think people are actually a little bit overheated about embracing social or not social media, AI at this point. But that's a really significant sea change. And I think it's great that we've learned that sometimes you need to embrace the emerging technology rapidly instead of reluctantly and too late. That said, there are significant differences. I think social media was easy to ignore because it was signaling a change in behavior on the part of our audience. Suddenly our alumni were gathering in the name of the institution in places and channels that didn't exist before. So it was very easy for a communicator who was heads down, making sure that the Dean's newsletter was going out on time and that the alumni magazine had the right photography, to just completely ignore the fact that all that was happening because we didn't have to deal with it. However, the real reason we did have to deal with it was that all of a sudden our audience wasn't where they used to be, and their expectations of what interaction felt like weren't the same as they used to be. And I think over time it became clear that we were just losing a lot of our ability to reach these folks because we weren't meeting them in the right place at the right time in the right channel and talking about things they cared about, right? So that was easy for higher ed to ignore, but it was a sea change in terms of the way that the audience behaved. I think it's a little bit the opposite with AI. I think AI, at least initially, is going to be something that changes the way that we work internally. And perhaps that explains why you see this explosion of excitement about the emergence of these tools. I don't actually think that AI is going to change the behavior of our audience immediately in the way that social media did. But it's going to change the way that we produce stuff for our audience and the way we present it to our audience and what we learn from that presentation. That said, I've been a little unsettled over the past week or so by the notion that the way it actually could change our audience's behavior is if it changes the way that the public in general responds to content, because they now know that a significant chunk of it is being produced by AI. And that could go in a whole range of different ways that it's very difficult to speculate about. But you know, if the broader societal distrust in institutions somehow gets married to broader societal distrust in content, period, like, that is a big problem for advancement. It may turn out that people are very pragmatic about content in a way that people are super pragmatic about algorithms and marketing. And then if they don't like what they're being presented with, they can say, that's terrible. I can't believe that these clowns are presenting AI-generated content to me. But if you like it, you're like, that's great. Give me more of that.
Yeah.
And then I can also imagine that this could open up a whole range of new opportunities for imagine a communications version of an organic farm, where part of your brand proposition is that we guarantee that you're only going to get content that was produced by human beings. It's sort of the equivalent of food that's only been produced without the use of any unnatural fertilizers, right?
Oh, wow.
And so I could totally imagine that there might be a market out there that is willing to either pay more attention to stuff that is certified as human grown, or is willing to pay a premium for it. And I don't have any clue how that will all shake out. But that's how I could see this all changing the way people behave in a way that's going to impact our work.
And it's happening all around us. It makes me think about emails that I get where I know I got it because I did a certain search or because I behaved in a certain way as a consumer. And it's getting to a point now where I'm seeing, oh, I'm getting this because of that. And sometimes it bothers me and sometimes it doesn't. And I would think that would be similar for a potential donor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an individual thing that's going to vary dramatically based on context, because it's just as easy for somebody to be upset if you show too much about why you're reaching out to them, as for them to be upset if they're like a 20-year volunteer and a loyal donor and you don't show in your content that you understand their history of engagement with the institution. But that's interesting, right? Then because so ever since I got to Cornell, one of the things I've heard over and over again from alumni is, why can't you be more like Amazon? And my stance has always been, I would love to be more like Amazon. There's just no way in the world I will ever be able to be like Amazon, given the technology I have access to and the budget I have to work with and a team the size of the team I have. So when I think about becoming like Amazon, I think with the emergence of AI and generative AI and marketing automation and all these tools that sort of tie all of these various different elements together, suddenly being like Amazon doesn't feel that far away. And I guess going back to the beginning of the conversation, that initial conference, there it was all this hypothetical pipe dream. I think we're now at a point where with the right investments and the right mindset, we're not that far away from being able to make real strides in that direction. But then that gets tricky because that only works if you've got data that is structured in the right way. Data is obviously the fuel that makes the AI engine work. And I think that's going to open up a whole new can of worms in that, by and large, a lot of advancement data is not structured in a way that's easily ingestible by AI. And then that gets interesting in that you can imagine the emergence of a tier of probably vendors whose value proposition is, you give me your data and we will transform it into a form that is ingestible by all of these tools that are now becoming available.
Yeah, and that makes me cringe because that's very nerve-wracking to think about too.
Oh, it totally is. And it's interesting. I've got a good friend who works in healthcare AI. And it's such an interesting series of parallels between healthcare and higher ed. Budgets are big, but they don't want to spend it on systems. Lots of people who are very wedded to doing things the way that they've always done them. Highly sensitive data on individuals, that there are all sorts of moral and ethical and legal and risk management hazards associated with. But at the same time, if you can figure out a way to take that data and put it in a way that it's easily shareable across multiple institutions in a totally anonymized way, and then you've got a data set that's not just a single institution's data set, but it's all of higher ed's data set or all of the Ivy Plus group or whatever community of practice you have, and then you can start turning some of these tools loose. I think, you know, the real value of things like machine learning is that they can handle data sets that humans will never be able to handle themselves. And they'll theoretically be able to tease out insights that we'll never see if we're relying solely on human agency to do it. And there's so much to be gained, but at the same time, there are so many obstacles to getting there. And I'll end this sidebar with the observation that as my friend's been thinking through how they position their service to healthcare systems and to hospitals, especially, the number one thing they realized was that these things don't integrate into the workflow that is already being used. There is no hope because doctors and nurses are way too busy to ever think about using a separate tool just for this. So they've worked at integrating them into the existing software packages. And that's so interesting because you see that's exactly what places like Microsoft are doing with Microsoft Copilot or Salesforce or these other big tech companies. They're integrating what did the recommendation call them? The vertical and embedded AI functions and packages that we're already using.
Seeping into the...
Yeah, it's like we'll be using AI before we even know it.
Yep.
And then actually most of the most vocally over my dead body folks are probably using AI enhanced stuff.
Yep.
Without even knowing they're doing it.
Well, then the last couple of minutes, you've done a really great job of outlining risks and rewards. And I'm sure people are thinking all sorts of things along those lines as they're listening now. Can you just tell us about a few of the use cases that you're using now and use cases that you think our colleagues and peers in higher ed fundraising and even nonprofit fundraising should be thinking about using now? I kind of like to end there.
Sure. These are more cool directions that we're going to be going as opposed to directions where I have 6 months of data, but we can talk again in 6 months and we can talk about this. So my first one is pretty basic, but it strikes me as funny because I've recently been on a task force that was developing guidelines for use of AI by communicators at Cornell. I'm in the middle with my partner, Debbie Krajewski-Werner, developing similar guidelines for use of AI by alumni affairs and development staff. And, you know, in both of these contexts, we've done a lot of talking with people throughout the communications and advancement organizations who have varying degrees of familiarity with this. They're worried about different things. The one thing that everybody agrees on is that if you could use generative AI to make the process of drafting position descriptions less painful, every single person would sign up for that in a heartbeat. And I'm 100% on board with that, right? And I think that that's actually one of the things that is going to happen sooner rather than later, being able to use AI to make things like that, these very routine formulaic exercises that really just require customization to reflect particular positions. That feels to me like that's likely to happen pretty soon, actually. There is a scenario that I'm really interested in having spent some time with Salesforce Marketing Cloud recently. The scenario here is that inside of Marketing Cloud and their Einstein Analytics package, which is AI powered, they have got some engagement scoring going on. And it's not engagement scoring that is hypothetical. It's all engagement scoring that's based on actual people who are receiving actual communications from you. And then it's segmenting people up according to how they're responding to your content. But it's basically, it's dividing people up into categories, or like the sort of, these aren't the exact category names, but like the true blues, the folks who always open it up and they always click. There are the people who always open it up, but they don't click. There are the people who sometimes do it. And then there are people who don't do anything at all. So I'm interested in that group that received the email, you know, it's getting there, but they don't tend to do anything. And then there's a whole series of tests that you can do within the system in an automated fashion to try to get them off the fence. One is pretty standard A/B testing with subject lines. Mm-hmm. So if you've got this audience that you know is getting the email, but there's not much at stake because they're not clicking through and therefore they're not giving money, you know, you can start iterating pretty fast on different approaches to subject lines and see if there are approaches to subject lines that actually will get them to click on through. And then where this intersects with the whole generative AI conversation is that there's now functionality within Marketing Cloud that pretty much writes emails for you. And you tell it, you know, what tone do you want it to have? You can probably provide it with some models to work off of. But this is the way that the generative AI changes what's possible in that world. I would never in a million years put human writer time doing experiments with an audience that just isn't responding and isn't giving, right? Like, okay, you want to maximize the ROI of your human time to focus on the people who are receptive to the content that they've been getting, and that makes sense on so many levels. So given that we have a fixed amount of writer bandwidth available, we're not doing anything to see if different approaches to content would make a difference for those folks who just aren't paying any attention. And let me back up for a second here, but to say that in general, I think, you know, you probably got 40% of your audience that's going to be with you regardless of what you do, 20% that's never going to be with you, but that other, the middle, the remaining 40%, those are the ones who are not alienated from the institution to the point that they'll never listen, but you're just not reaching them in a meaningful way. So if suddenly the system lets me know who that audience is, and they give me a quick and easy way to rapidly generate different approaches to content that doesn't take time away from the writers who are actually doing the high ROI stuff with the libunts and the sibunts, suddenly we can begin to experiment and see if we can figure out ways to connect with this 40% in a way that we couldn't before. And I think that's a great example of how this technology will enable us to do things that always would have been nice on paper, but we simply couldn't do because of sort of budgetary and human bandwidth constraints.
And I think people would agree that that's quote unquote safe too.
Totally. Yeah. There is zero risk because they're not giving, right?
Right.
And that's always been one of the obstacles that we've encountered in the past, trying to experiment with the broader audience, which is people saying, well, we don't want to jeopardize what's coming through the door, but with these folks who aren't leaving anyway, it's all good, right? Like there's no downside. And then what if we figure it out? What if there's a substantial upside if we can just unlock it? Final example would be reporting. Leadership loves reporting. Understandable, especially if you're trying to cultivate a culture of being data informed. But depending on how hodgepodgey your systems are, reporting is super, super time intensive. And going through multiple cycles of, well, this is super interesting, but can you tweak variables X, Y, and Z and then come back to me with it? That is not a fast thing. And some of these tools, including ChatGPT-4, they have pretty significant data reporting capabilities that crucially you mobilize with sort of a chat interface. So imagine a scenario where instead of having to go to your business analyst and say, okay, here's a hypothetical. Okay, out of all the people who've given to Cornell Giving Day over the past decade, tell me what the key differences are between the alumni donors from 2015 and the alumni donors from Giving Day 10 in 2024. And that's all you need to put in. And boom, it goes out there. And presumably, this is all in some sort of a gated area where we can have all the data and we're comfortable with it. It wouldn't work otherwise. But then it understands the requests and it comes back with it. And
that's amazing.
Then you're like, this is great. Can you give me a slice for a young alumni? And it just goes out and it pulls it on back. And all of a sudden, you eliminate all of this human energy that goes into manipulating the data we've got in such a way that we can answer this question. And holy cow, imagine the productivity that could unlock when people in every single program area can query their data and get almost real-time insight because there's a generative AI tool that can work well with your data set. That's exciting stuff.
Wow, that's an amazing note to end on. And it does make me feel like the possibilities are limitless. And also, I think another thing I didn't fully appreciate before this conversation was that so much of what AI can do for us is internal, is how we do our work inside.
Which is probably the greatest upside and the biggest obstacle.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard. Change is hard.
Yeah.
But it's easier when there's a nice bright light at the end of the tunnel, I would argue.
Yeah.
And the other thing, this is coming whether we like it or not. So I feel like it's much better to get out in front of it than be dragged along kicking and screaming behind.
Well, ride the wave.
Exactly. Exactly.
And Andrew, what do you know for sure?
It's not going away. And it will be easier to engage with proactively than it will be to try to catch up later. And I've also seen this said of both individual contributors and managers. I don't think that AI will replace individual contributors and managers as a category of staff, but I think that individual contributors and managers who can use AI are going to have an insurmountable advantage over the staff who can't.
Well, thank you so much. It was so great to have you, and thank you for all of your insights.
Oh, you're welcome. And this is exciting stuff. It's a fun time.